you very much. So our final speaker is Michael Paul Wallace, who's going to do AI and the Apocalyptic Imagination, the Ends of Divine, Natural, and Artificial Agency. Another long title, and so we'll see if we can have a good discussion on this one.
Yeah.
So you just got to click on the, we can escape that one, and that should be yours. The view, full screen.
Beginning.
All right, so you've got
right.
The
clicker's right there.
Yeah, so left or right.
Yeah.
We're a little early. But
yeah, we're a little early, so.
If anyone's come in or wants to hear your talk, you can definitely wait for a minute or two. Because
sure, absolutely. People, there's some seats kind of scattered around the room here.
When they start early, and I miss this
time. Yeah.
Room for more.
All right. So I have a script I'm going to try to stick to. I'm tempted to go off a lot of different tangents based on some of the other stuff that has come up. But, sorry. Yeah, is there, I guess there's no mic, is there?
So not for amplification.
Right, okay. All right, I will speak up. I have a script. I'm going to try to stay to it. So, you know, I want to leave time for questions and answers, although I'm a little nervous with this group. Some really good questions. So as I'm sort of moving through this, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of different avenues we could go down, and I'm happy to come back to those in the Q&A time or during the break or throughout the rest of the conference. So I'll go ahead and get started. And I'm actually going to start with someone on Jennifer's list that you're going to hear a little bit more about, philosopher of information, Luciano Floridi. Kind of a lead philosopher in a new area of kind of philosophy of information. But Floridi argues that we are living through an information revolution. So new information and communication technologies are changing our self-understanding, how we relate to one another, and how we understand our role in the world. And they are doing so, he says, pervasively, profoundly, and relentlessly. At the center of this revolution is the advent of automated information processing and intelligence systems, technologies of artificial intelligence. The advancing integration of AI into our lives leads many to believe that it will inaugurate a radical new period of human history, or even a new form of life. Broadly defined, AI is a growing set of interactive, autonomous, and self-learning techniques that enable computational artifacts to perform tasks that otherwise would require human intelligence. As a new and increasingly powerful form of agency, AI is rapidly reshaping our daily practices, personal and professional interactions, and our environments. These changes raise a number of ethical questions, and they inspire a range of hopes and fears. In the words of John Brockman, AI is the second coming and the apocalypse at the same time. Indeed, the tendency towards utopian and dystopian extremes is a recurring characteristic of dominant AI narratives. Some of these narratives are optimistic and utopian, anticipating AI will solve known problems and create a superior form of life and existence. Others are pessimistic and dystopian, expecting AI to exacerbate old problems and create new ones. The most extreme anticipations and anxieties include apocalyptic visions of an earthly paradise, post-human immortality, and the end of the human species and our civilization. So eschatological narratives about AI often draw from Judeo-Christian apocalyptic categories, and therefore they present an opportunity for a deeper engagement with the apocalyptic imagination as we reflect on hopes and fears associated with our information revolution. In this presentation, I'd like to explore how the Christian apocalyptic imagination can provide a constructive conceptual and narrative framework for viewing our current information revolution as an information revelation about artificial agency participating in new creation. I'll begin with an overview of four major information revolutions that have occurred throughout history. So we got history of computer science in 80 years, 5 minutes. I'm going to do about 100,000 years in about that time of information. I'll try. And I'd like to consider some of the theological implications of which that have sort of led up to our current moment. I'll then focus on AI and contrast a few popular apocalyptic narratives inspired by AI with an alternative apocalyptic narrative inspired by the Christian doctrine of new creation. Finally, I'll conclude by considering briefly how the apocalyptic imagination can help us reflect on an area of significant concern related to AI, that is the future of work. So Floridi identifies our current information as the fourth modern scientific revolution. Like the Copernican, Darwinian, and Freudian revolutions that preceded it, this revolution will significantly alter our understanding of ourselves and our place in the universe. But as our appreciation of the significance of information as a concept and a reality that shapes us and our world deepens, it is evident that other information revolutions have preceded our present one. Beyond the role of environmental and biological information in nature and human evolution, four major information revolutions have shaped human history. Each of these revolutions significantly enhanced human agency and also revealed new insights about what a human being is and about our role in the universe. From a theological perspective, each information revolution, including our present one, is also an information revelation about our agencies, our agency, natures, and gods. So the first major information revolution occurred about 100,000 years ago, give or take 50,000 years or more, after about 2 million years of manipulating the natural environment and influencing natural selection through lithic and other technologies, humans developed the capacity for information abstraction. This is the ability to imagine a world other than the one they saw. Imaginative language followed, which included the capability to communicate more information, as well as misinformation and disinformation, about other people, observed and unobserved phenomena, and creative possibilities. The abstraction of information revolutionized how humans functioned as information agents, who are now able to create plans, stories, social systems, and new environments. They could also imagine and contemplate a deeper spiritual dimension to reality, including new knowledge of good and evil. It's interesting that Yuval Harari calls this the tree of knowledge mutation. By 100,000 years ago, following the agricultural revolution, the second information revolution came with the establishment of the earliest cities. These artificial environments depended on political, economic, and religious institutions that operated as information agencies, organizations responsible for rules, trade, and cultural narratives that structured and sustained civic life. The city became a complex, future-oriented technology, a multi-agent system that aggregated and extended human agency in space and time, almost like an ancient form of AI. The third information revolution occurred about 5,000 years ago, when information agencies developed written communication and information artifacts. In Sumerian cities, mnemonic pictographic symbols evolved into a coded system of wedge-shaped marks called cuneiform, which were used to record administrative and literary texts on stone and clay tablets. Information management systems, such as archives and libraries, were established for their access and preservation, and humans began using material texts to communicate throughout larger communities, across generations, and with God. John Hott argues that anticipatory religions emerged around this time. He describes these as a global awakening to the future fulfillment of the universe and being grasped by that which is to come, the future that comes to meet us, take hold of us, and makes us new. In the midst of the third information revolution, to use the language of Hugh of St. Victor, Jesus Christ became the third book of creation, mediating new information and new creation. Hugh distinguished between three major forms of creative work. First is the work of God informing the world out of nothing. This establishes the subsequent work of nature. Second is the work of humans, the work, he said, of the artificer, which adds to nature. This work is corruptible and can deform relationships with God, others, nature, and our own creations. Third is the work of Christ, which includes his life, the scriptures and sacraments, and the church. The work of Christ, mediated through embodied, textual, and ecclesial forms, takes up and transforms all work into new creation. Humans, Hugh claimed that the uniqueness of human nature included the power to imagine what is not present, to communicate this information, and to transform understanding into action. When imagination and information result in the contemplation of truth, and when actions are virtuous, we approach wisdom. For Hugh, technology had a central role in reforming our relationship with God and nature. It is part of the human quest for wisdom. It extends our abilities and understanding. And when used wisely, it can reform and transform what has been deformed. Technology can be part of Christ's work of new creation, reconciling divine natural and human artificial creativity. So within the last 100 years or so, information automation technologies have created a fourth information revolution. Now, with new advances in AI, including automated perception, analysis, and action, we are only beginning to understand what human agency could or should look like in a world full of autonomous and intelligent artificial agents. Now, current AI systems use a variety of information processing techniques to accomplish different goals, but these are very specific or narrow programs. From the beginning, though, general or human-level intelligence has been the holy grail of AI development. Many today still see this as the real goal of AI. This goes beyond modeling discrete human-like capabilities such as vision, language, and reasoning. The idea of artificial general intelligence, AGI, is to master everything of which human intelligence is capable. AI could then surpass it, become super intelligent, ASI, and continue to develop on its own. This could be great, this could be terrible, depending on whether or not it aligns with our values. Now, whether or not AGI and ASI are possible is a matter of intense debate. Flaherty characterizes the extreme positions as atheist and singularitarian. The belief on the one hand that AI is just regular computing, and the opposing belief that AI will reach a point, the singularity, when it surpasses human intelligence. AI experts and enthusiasts can be found at either end. Well, not the enthusiasts, they're at one end. But people interested in AI can be found all over the place and everywhere in between the extremes. Now, while a broad ethical consensus appears to be emerging around major areas of concern, such as data collection, attentional autonomy, information authenticity, algorithmic explicability, and social justice issues, further foresight analysis must be done, not only of what is plausible, but of what is desirable. So hopes associated with utopian eschatologies anticipate AI to increase production and prosperity, thereby eliminating hunger and poverty, and to find solutions to health, energy, ecological, and economic challenges. By solving these problems, AI could lead us into a more fulfilling, peaceful world and create new opportunities for human creativity, discovery, relationships, and leisure. For singularitarians, AGI and ASI inspire hopes for an enhanced and extended human or even post-human life. Chief among these optimists is Ray Kurzweil, who imagines we will ultimately merge with the intelligent technology we are creating. Max Tegmark, another proponent, prominent AI optimist, claims AGI can enable us to finally become the masters of our own destiny, to upgrade life and free it from its evolutionary shackles. Now, fears associated with dystopian eschatologies of narrow AI include anxieties about bias, accountability, surveillance, autonomous weapons, and adverse uses. When speculations about AGI and ASI are added to these, especially about the possibility of an intellect greater than ours with ends unknown, even the optimistic Tegmark can imagine more dystopian than utopian outcomes. If our technology outpaces the wisdom with which we manage it, he admits, it can lead to our extinction. Nick Bostrom worries that we may get a future shaped in accordance with alien criteria, random, unforeseen, and unwanted. Now, Michael Burdett, in Eschatology and the Technological Future, argues that Christian eschatology can provide a more robust account of the future than that offered by technological futurism. Most AI technologies or technological eschatologies are products of futurism, which consider the future as an outworking of present conditions and forces. So the future is a product of what has preceded it. The Christian theological approach to the future, however, is inspired by Adventus, by that which is coming. It is driven by what is ahead. Since Jewish and Christian apocalyptic traditions and categories have, according to Robert Geraci, thoroughly penetrated the futuristic musings of important researchers in AI, apocalyptic AI scenarios create an opportunity for theological reflection on alternative apocalyptic narratives. These could awaken us to greater hopes for the future and the world. The earliest Jewish apocalypses functioned to orient oppressed people to a new vision, of the past, present, and future. They provided a conceptual and narrative framework that opened up deeper dimensions of knowledge, space, time, and agency to reveal a new and better world. N.T. Wright explains, apocalypse is not about denying the present creation, but about overcoming its sorrows and realizing its promise. For early Christians, the sudden fulfillment of divine promise, which had come about through the gospel of Jesus, revealed new information about new creation. This apocalyptic information reoriented knowledge, time, community, and action toward a new end. At the end of the biblical narrative, we see the final great vision of God's promised future in the New Jerusalem. In his commentary on Revelation, Brian Blount emphasizes the objective reality of John's apocalyptic expectations. In his climatic visions of the end, he connects Christ's coming with a tangible, measurable, objective city. Blount notes, new creation is not completely discontinuous from the one that went before it. In making all things new, God is taking what is old and transforming it. The focal object of new creation, New Jerusalem, is new, holy, and urban. Blount writes, John signals a salvific identity concretized in the communal relationships that exist in an urban environment. John's vision redeems the earth as part of God's good creation and as the locus of God's grand recreation. A follower of Christ, Blount concludes, works with God to transform the world. The apocalyptic hope that comes from this vision of God's urban end emphasizes the future and present significance of human agency. The Christian apocalyptic imagination provides us with a rich resource reflected on areas of significant concern related to AI. And I want to touch briefly on one of these, the future of work. Ongoing automation and applications of AI are expected to accelerate changes in the workplace, making some jobs obsolete, creating new jobs, and changing most jobs. John Markoff points out, whether labor is vanquishing or being transformed, it's clear that this new automation age is having a profound impact on society. Kurzweil anticipates unprecedented economic growth in a world in which jobs will be irrelevant. The key issues, he says, will be purpose and meaning. Tegmark believes any reasons for work beyond compensation can be provided outside the workplace. For example, through sports, hobbies, and learning, and with families, friends, and teams, clubs, community groups, schools, religions, and humanistic organizations, political movements, and other institutions. But is there a deeper meaning to work itself? In Why Work, Dorothy Sayers argued that work is the natural exercise and function of the creature who is made in the image of one's creator. She said, work is not primarily a thing one does to live, but the thing one lives to do. It is or should be the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which one finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which one offers oneself to God. What seems implicit in Sayers' idealization of work is much more explicit in Miroslav Volf's eschatological vision of work. He grounds a theology of work in the doctrine of new creation. Work leads the present world of work toward promised and hoped-for transformation. From the opening chapters of Genesis to the final chapters of Revelation, divine and human work link the beginning with the end. If, as T.S. Eliot wrote apocalyptically, our end is not in our beginning, but rather our beginning is in our end, we can understand the ultimate meaning of work best, I think, through the image of New Jerusalem. There, the ends of divine, natural, and human artificial agency are fulfilled together. God establishes a new heaven, earth, and city. Nature fills the city with beauty, life, and healing. And humans bring the honor and glory of the nations, products of our work, into the holy city. The creation of autonomous and intelligent technologies has inaugurated a new revolutionary age for us and our world. A recent report from the Royal Society on AI narratives emphasizes that narratives are essential to the development of science and people's engagement with new knowledge and new applications. Bringing eschatological AI narratives into conversation with theologically informed visions of the future can enrich narratives about AI, providing deeper perspectives on areas of significant concern, such as the future of work. Moreover, a truly apocalyptic narrative can provide a framework for properly relating divine, natural, and human agency, and for understanding how our newest artificial creations may participate in new creation. Thank you. Questions? Oh, yeah.
We'll be computers in heaven.
I don't want to get too critical, too literal. But we, you know, computers is a proxy for what?
Technology.
Yeah. Yes.
Could you comment on the invention of the printing press around about 500 years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
The impact that had, and then about 100 years ago, we had wireless communication.
Yep.
Remember, before wireless, it was the information across the Atlantic took a sailing ship.
Yeah.
Or it was weeks before you get information. Could you comment on those two revolutions in?
Yeah.
Those two changes of the printing press, number one, and then wireless or global. Suddenly we had instantaneous global communication.
Yep.
Could you comment on the impact?
I mean, you know, those were significantly revolutionary type things. You know, there's a lot of debate about how radical the printing press was. You know, we already had manuscript culture. We had, you know, produced a lot of books prior to the printing press. The printing press obviously proliferated the types of books and the amount of books. Also led to more literacy, and of course that fed into the whole Protestant Reformation, you know, sort of created the foundation for that. So yes, and then wireless, the more sort of remote immediate ability to communicate, both very important revolutions. I tend to think of those as sort of extensions of writing, at least the printing press. The instantaneous communication across wires, I do kind of see that leading up into the more sort of age of automation in terms of the technologies that led to that and were built upon that. But still, very, you know, with more time. Yeah. Yes?
So your talk got me thinking about maybe some limitations of the way we think about new creation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think even though we've become, you know, more new heavens and new earth-minded rather than just heavenly-minded about the future, I think we still maybe think pretty statically about what the new creation will be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, beatific vision.
Yeah.
Parts of heaven and paradise and so on. But, you know, if you have this sort of apocalyptic technological side of things, and you know, it's a big question here. You know, what's history going to look like in the new creation? What's technological development going to look like in the new creation? What's work? You know, what are we going to do? What does our work mean? Are we going to keep building things and doing things and discovering things? Well, you know, what are you thinking about?
Well, you know, we always start with the fact we have very little knowledge, right? We have images, we have suggestions of things. But what's really interesting when you focus on the city, you know, at the end of the biblical narrative and, you know, at the end of the kind of salvation history, is that it's a city. I mean, why not the garden? We don't, you know, go back to the garden and sort of, you know, leave our tools behind. You know, and there's even different views of the city. I mean, someone like Jacques Ellul, you know, is very negative about the city. The city is this evil agent and has to be completely destroyed, and then God's got to do something entirely new. So part of, you know, the question with eschatology is sort of continuity and discontinuity, where the balance is. But you started by pointing to what I think is important for us to not lose sight of is the material nature of that end point. It isn't some disembodied spiritual experience. It's a spiritual body, whatever that means. But there is a sense of the body. And so, you know, you have images, of course, of the resurrected Jesus appearing in bodily form. So, again, we don't have a lot of information, but, you know, the few images we have, I think, are rather suggestive. And in my reading of the Bible, this suggests a little bit more continuity than some others might see. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I really appreciate this talk. My question is you brought up Yuval Harari and Ray Kurzweil, and I recently did a bit of work with them, especially Eric Steinhardt has noted that a lot of the transhumanist movement is built subconsciously on the work of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit priest, very unconsciously working with the progressive framework that he was wise enough to ground theologically.
Mm-hmm.
And so he accuses them of assuming a Christian framework and then putting into, especially about Harari, who posits it as an alternative religion, of basically just creating a secularized Christian religion based off the work of Pierre Teilhard. And honestly, I just wanted to know, like, do you see your work interacting with that? Like, what's your comments on that?
Yeah, well, Derek's going to talk about this afternoon. You know, this does connect with transhumanism. I didn't really have time to get into that because what transhumanism is very contested. You know, who gets to define it? You know, and there's a Christian Transhumanism Association where they're trying to sort of kind of bring Christianity together with a vision of transhumanism. So I think that the easy answer to the question is that that a Christian understanding of the end involves divine intervention or a divine agency and a role in that. Most transhumanists are not interested in sort of anything about divine agency. It's about sort of materialistic solutions to challenges of aging and death. So maybe I'll stop at that. But I'd love to have the conversation further. Because I think it's this is very closely related to a lot of those discussions. Although that is sort of a more specialized application of some of the technologies I'm talking about. Yes.
Do you ever wonder if you said a spiritual body, that the new heavens and the new earth and our embodied existence, there might be a Kurzweil esque singularity, merging of machine and biological. Anybody thinking about?
I'm not thinking about that.
Christian perspective.
Well, as I say, there is a Christian Transhumanist Association, and so there are people who are, the relationship between to what extent are we participating in the realization of new creation? And so some people want to go a lot farther with that. This is sort of the old 20th century debates about post-millennialism or premillennialism. Is it, do humans build it or do humans just wait and God drops it down? I think, most of us are probably in the middle of those two extreme positions now. But I think that the point of going back over the last 100,000 years or so is sort of seeing how human agency has evolved and developed over time. And I do see that as sort of a trajectory that I expect will continue through the end. But the details of whether that involves like whole brain replication uploaded on servers or in robots, I don't know. Yes?
So, the journey from Genesis to Revelation is one of humans seeking a covenant with God and reaching some kind of New Jerusalem, which is incidentally a place where heaven and earth meet. So, again, in AI terms, where that's a values-driven process. Okay? So where is the values input in AI?
That's a very complicated question. I mean, are you talking like ethics of design, or intention and sort of how we're building these technologies? What?
Well, is it incumbent in the programming? Are the values there, or is there always a human master that's making sure the machine's running correctly? In which case,
right.
Is it AI to start? Why would you call it AI?
Right, and I think this is. I mean, I see this as very complicated in that and just kind of picking up some things that were said earlier. Our tools are not neutral. We design these things with certain intentions. They inherit these kind of agentic qualities, and then people use them and exert their own agency. So you have to, I think you have to think of it in terms of a multi-agent perspective. What are designers doing as they develop the things? What are the users doing as they use the things? What are their intervening structures and mechanisms and institutions and organizations? So it is, so the question of values is sort of everywhere. Now I think if you, a lot of the real interesting questions about the ethics of design, I mean, that's probably where you start the discussion. And it's like, why are we building these things? What are we building them for? Things like that. That's where you would think more about values alignment.
And don't forget about emergence.
Now, yeah, and the emergence, that would be a really interesting conversation to go, and maybe, you know, again, in a strong sense, like the emergence of consciousness, or a softer sense, and just simply like these, you know, these are learning tools, and they're sort of doing things and coming up with solutions that we don't necessarily see or expect on our own. So I guess I would agree with a softer sense of emergence. I'm a little bit agnostic or about sort of hard sense of emergence, like, you know, consciousness. But yeah. Yeah.
Just a shameless plug, the Perspectives of Science and Christian Faith, this most recent issue that just came out, is a special issue dedicated to artificial intelligence. And if you haven't seen it yet and you're interested in Christian scholars thinking about that, that's one place to start.
Yep. That's good.
References that are quite there too.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks.
And there's one on transhumanism that's going to come out in a, I don't know, a year or so.
Oh, okay, good. All right, well, again, I'm happy to answer questions throughout the rest of the conference. Thank you.
We're out of time in an hour and 4 minutes. We'll be back in 15 minutes.